So my brother is back home visiting Ireland this week, and I've got to admit that I am very jealous. I haven't been home myself since before the pandemic. And for those who don't know, I grew up in Dublin, and I'm so proud of all that Ireland has become in terms of both diversity and social policy. It's been quite amazing to watch as somebody who grew up there. David McWilliams wrote a book called Renaissance Nation: How the Pope's Children Rewrote the Rules for Ireland. It's a great read, and in it he writes, Ireland went through a progressive culture war, becoming more tolerant and richer as other countries became less tolerant and less rich, end quote. It's really been wild to see, and it's wild to imagine that Ireland, in terms of topics such as same-sex marriage rights and abortion rights, has become a clear international leader. It's no longer a country that's co-piloted by the Catholic Church, which is the way it was when I was growing up. So if you get a chance, David McWilliams, his book is well worth the read. Now, let's get back to today's episode. Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. And here's a clip from today's episode.
But I suppose what I would say is not to narrow too fast. When I've been working with companies more recently on this, what we've tended to do is to pick off three or four behaviors that feel relevant or interesting to the category or our audience, and then begin to think about how could we respond to it. And the response can be, you know, it can be in three different ways, really. You can come straight down the line at it, you know, see. Living off the sea is a massive opportunity. People are very open to it. Could I bring it into my food product? Or you can look at it as what does it tell me? What is this behavior telling me about these people? So my wicker example. And the third way actually is more, could I use this as inspiration to help me break through a really difficult category?
That's Helen Edwards. Her new book is From Marginal to Mainstream: Why Tomorrow's Brand Growth Will Come from the Fringes. And it's a perfect episode three in our Outside In Thinking series. We talk about marginal behaviors and how they can fast become mainstream disruptors, and about the dangers of calcified ways of thinking. This isn't just a conversation about what marginal behaviors are, but about how to identify them in your category. And in the second part of the conversation, we also talk about whom these types of behaviors are most likely to attract and ignite. But I wanted to underscore the importance of listening to this episode, not simply through the lens of long-term product innovation, but also the lens of what we can be delivering today as strategists and marketers in our strategies and messaging for existing products and services. For example, what are people getting out of marginal activities that they're not getting elsewhere? What is the need that these marginal activities are meeting? And are we able to use our existing products and services to meet those unmet needs? You know, ones that we can meet today with existing products or existing services. And if we're able to do that, to meet that unmet need in the marginal emerging segment, then there's a very strong chance that if that ignites in the mainstream, that we can be ahead of the game. So I think that there's two ways to listen to today's episode, and hopefully we can keep those two lenses open as we go through this. Once again, we're joined by Steve McCarron from the planning department. They're the sponsor of this series. Welcome back, Steve.
It's good to be here.
So, in this series, we've been talking about the importance of outside-in thinking as a way to avoid what Helen Edwards describes in this episode as entrenched behaviors and perspectives. Now, you know, we all know that traditionally planning has been undertaken in-house by agencies or brands themselves. What do you think are the advantages of using an outside planning function?
Well, Fergus, I've always thought that the client-agency relationship is a really healthy thing because agencies, by sitting outside of client organizations, do bring that outside perspective. They're well placed to challenge complexity of organizations, entrenched habits within organizations, and that unconscious bias that can exist within organizations. And so I think that setup really puts them in a good place to create breakthrough thinking. However, over time, what we found is that even agencies themselves recognize that they can get pulled into some of that organizational groupthink. Simply by working with the client for a long time, they can absorb some of the prejudices of that organization and some of the shared beliefs that that organization has about what works and what doesn't. I think what an outside planning department function does that you can plug in, it enables agencies to more proactively provide that fresh perspective. They can do it in a more deliberate way.
That's Steve McCarron of the Planning Department in Manchester, England. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, Fergus.
We'll be right back with Helen Edwards. This series is sponsored by the Planning Department, a new breed of strategy agency that lets you access a world-class planning department as and when you need it. Think of it as having a planning department without the year-round overhead. Based in the UK, they're a group of researchers and strategists spread across the globe with diverse proven experience across all major categories. As outside voices, they bring fresh, objective perspective to brand and business problems. So if you're interested in having world-class brand and communication strategists on your business, be sure to connect with them, because the best ideas happen when you bring the outside in. Learn more at theplanningdepartment.co.uk. That's theplanningdepartment.co.uk. Now back to the show. Hi, and welcome, Helen.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. So it's a mutual kind of appreciation society, because this is one of my favorite podcasts. So thank you for inviting me on.
Let's jump in. And I hope that we're going to inspire people with a number of different things, because there are a lot of assumptions made in marketing. And I think that there's a lot of assumptions made within corporations in terms of growth and where growth can come from. It's as if we sort of feel, we definitely feel the pressure of growth. But the reality of achieving growth is something that isn't talked about enough. And we kind of feel that it's, I think we're under the impression that it's without limit, or that growth is inevitable if we do some basic things. Why do you think so many categories have become what we've discovered, which is really sort of low growth zones?
I think it's because... Well, I think you're right to say, you know, marketers are the ones that are often charged with growth. Where is growth going to come from? And we almost always aim for breakthrough growth, don't we? It's that expression of sort of breakthrough. It sends everyone into sort of paralysis. But if you look at it, really, in a lot of categories, what we're looking at is small percentage gains here and there. And I, for me, one of the primary reasons for that is that we look inwards before we look outwards. So as marketers, we tend to look inside at our own category and go, oh, what can I do through my core and extended core, is the standard language, to get some growth? You know, how can I catch up? Have we got the latest, you know, bond building technology if you're in hair care? Have we got the latest flavor? Are we adding that service to our online experience? And it all starts with catch up. We look inside before we look outside at what are people, even before they get to consumers, what are people wanting and how do they want to live their lives and how could we serve them better? What we've neglected is demand side, consumer driven disruption, if you like. So that's when consumers, and it often starts as a very small number of consumers right there in the margins or the fringes, are choosing to live their lives in a certain way. And then that ripple becomes a wave, and it can disrupt and change the landscape of whole categories. And there will be winners and losers, just like there are in supply side disruptive innovation. There will be winners and losers when you look to demand side or consumer driven disruption, which is, you know, what I'm all about thinking about, because I think it brings a new angle of innovation into companies that they're not currently looking at.
And this is not about consumer-driven innovation, i.e. I'll do some focus groups and ask consumers what they want. I mean, there's too much assumption that a consumer knows what they want. And there's an awful lot of strong supported opinions that realize that consumers are a very poor guide to what they want, right?
Absolutely. No, it's not about asking consumers what they want. It's about observing how people are living their lives. Now, you can do that via ethnography. You can do that via there are lots of methodologies you can use, but it's definitely not about asking consumers what they want. It's about observing in the first instance, how are people choosing to live their lives? And so, you know, in the book, what I talk about is marginal behaviors. I was really interested in how veganism, after spending, you know, decades, veganism was originally, you know, conceived in the sort of late 40s, but it did nothing for decades. And it was only in around 2017 that veganism took off. And so what are the marginal behaviors are out there that small groups of people are choosing to do that could take off and disrupt whole categories and provide new avenues for growth? So kind of what could be another veganism was what I was really trying to look at when I started researching the book. And it's so rather than look on the inside, it's like look on the outside, look at the fringes for how people are choosing to live their lives and think about and find a methodology for understanding those fringe behaviors better and which ones might become more mainstream.
So we're looking at the margins for sort of clues about tomorrow's mainstream, right? So when you talk about, you use the term marginal behaviors, can you share a couple of examples of what marginal behaviors are?
Yeah, so we kind of self-defined. When I say we, it's because I had a whole team working with me on the research, but we defined marginal behaviors as behaviors, a way of living, or behaviors that something that people choose to do that less than 3% of the population are currently doing it, and we couldn't always measure it. So it was a bit of a kind of, we think that's about right, that are not consumer-driven, not consumption-driven in the first instance. So it's not in the first instance about consuming something. It's about wanting to live your life a certain way. And they are not driven primarily by religion or politics. So good examples of that would be, I mean, the one that floated to the top of our, came out at the top of our scale was actually living from the sea. Now, that doesn't mean eating more fish. What that means is looking for ways to use kelp, which is a protein which grows incredibly fast in the ocean, looking for ways to use kelp in different parts of our lives and using the sea as a respected resource rather than plundering it for stuff that we can take. So there was a sort of beautiful convergence of factors with this one, which is why it rose to the top of our scale, in that people weren't very resistant to it. There are lots of marginal behaviors that people are resistant to. They're not resistant to it. They're open to it. They believe that if we respect the sea as a resource, we'll respect the sea more. And there are lots of opportunities in ways that we can use kelp. Like you can use kelp, for example, in packaging, and the packaging just sort of disappears. So it's very sustainable. But another example would be microdosing, actually, which is taking very small amounts of psilocybin, magic mushrooms, to just get a small lift. So it's about 1/10 of a tryptose. Now, what's really interesting about this is it's not legal in a lot of countries. You know, it is legal in Canada, and I think in some states in the US, not legal in the UK, legal in Holland. Now, this really appeals to people because, I mean, I teach students every week, and I reckon, you know, I've got a lot of students who don't smoke, don't drink, don't vape, they do microdose. And it's because they see it as a more natural way to get a small lift, and it doesn't have all those sort of, you know, binge connotations that a lot of those other things do. So microdosing is another example, and I think is one to watch because I think legislation will change. And I think it also tells experienced brands, so if you think about big alcohol brands, it tells you something about what people are looking for in their downtime that you might be able to respond to differently.
Are these marginal behaviors things that are at the early stage of being commercialized by somebody else, or are they at a sort of an experimental phase amongst small communities of people who are playing with it? I mean, is that part of what defines a marginal behavior?
I think it varies. So I think you can almost, in most of them, we found entrepreneurial activity. So for example, when I talk about the kelp and living from the sea, there is a really interesting packaging company called Nopla who are making packaging out of kelp. And if you think about microdosing, for example, you know, where it's legal, there are companies that are doing that. But also I do know that there are large alcohol brands who are looking at it, looking at that behavior and thinking, okay, how do we respond to this? What does it tell us? Will legislation change? And if you take something like polyphasic sleeping, which is sleeping in a way that suits your body rather than in the traditional 8 hours at night and then you're awake all day, which actually is more attuned to natural sleeping. Now, what's interesting about that is COVID kind of gave that a shove because it accelerated it, because people working from home realized they could sleep in a way that suited them and their lifestyle. And that can be continued. And, you know, there are some really interesting entrepreneurial businesses almost always in these areas. But you can see the opportunities there in polyphasic sleeping around apps, how offices would be designed, you know, and working from home, obviously.
If we look at things like tattoos, if we look at personal fitness, if we look at electric vehicles, if we look at mental wellness, that entire industry, at one time, not that, you know, maybe a couple of decades, well, then this is maybe the challenge, is that maybe a decade or two ago, these weren't really realized categories in any mainstream way. And now they have mainstreamed. But we forget about that. We forget about the fact that these were almost categories that were mocked at the very beginning.
Yeah. I mean, exercise for its own sake just sort of blew my mind when we started looking at it. Because in 1968, someone was arrested in America for jogging on the public highway. Arrested for jogging. It's just mad. It's because nobody did it. And obviously, if someone was seen running down the public highway, they were running for a reason. And it was really the start of the exercise revolution was jogging, and it was brought over to America by Bill Bowerman, who was one of the founders of Blue Ribbon Sports that then became Nike. And, you know, and it was that was the beginning of the exercise revolution. Now, there are some reasons why it happened in that working life had become more sedentary in the 50s, and we had many more labor-saving devices. So heart disease was an issue. And so the American culture, and it did start in America, was looking for a way to get people out of their sedentary lifestyles. And jogging was the beginning of that. But look at now if you, and that's the beginning of the exercise revolution. And then if you think about the next 10 years, it's, and this is the thing about marginal behaviors, is it's not one category or one brand that benefits. It's multiple categories and multiple brands that can benefit. So the exercise revolution is, you know, clothing and apparel, gyms, experiences, you know, food and drink, tech-enabled fitness. It's multi-category when one of these behaviors takes off. And I would say the same for sort of mindfulness. You know, meditation has been around for a long time, but really once someone reframed it, Jon Kabat-Zinn, I think, as mindfulness, and then along with the whole kind of sleep category, you get category growth across multiple categories. It provides that opportunity.
So the challenge there is the fact that many of these that have mainstreamed, it hasn't happened quickly. And so in the corporate culture where we're looking at quarter by quarter performance, how are we supposed to, number one, make a commitment to something that, while we might have to invest in it now, it might not, even if it's successful, return a profit for many, many years? Is that, how do we sort of reconcile that trade-off?
Well, I think a couple of things, really. I think once they go, they go. So if you take veganism, which really took off in 2017, you know, it's now a growing category worth billions. And that's just vegan food and drink. That's before you get into kind of vegan beauty, healthcare, medicines, clothes, furniture. So that's not a long time. When they go very quickly, as did exercise for its own sake. But what happens is they're around for quite a long time. And I guess the point is that you've got to be able to read them, understand which ones might be moving into the mainstream, and experiment, start setting up experiments quickly in that area about how you as a business can respond. And I think it is about, you know, if you think about the innovation budget, if you like, all I would argue for is to say, I think a small amount of this innovation budget, of your innovation budget, should be focused on looking at marginal behaviors and the opportunities and testing opportunities for your business. Because really you're talking about 5 year out growth. And most companies tend to think about growth as what can we do in the next couple of years? What can we do in the next 2 to 3 years, which might be an acquisition, or we might, you know, have a new technology we're developing. And this, looking to the margins, thinking about how people want to live their lives, thinking about how you can respond to it as a business, I think we're in the 5 years area. And most businesses are looking at how, where will we be in 5 years' time? And where do we know our growth is going to come from? I think it sits there, if you like, in the innovation conversation.
Is that why we see so much acquisition behavior in categories, that there's this point of view that we want it to sort of in the early stages to incubate in companies that are dedicated to it, and then of course we will then acquire the company in order to acquire that solution, that technology, that expertise? Is that part of how big companies tend to react to marginal behaviors as they begin to emerge?
I think so, because I think that is also about risk, but I don't think it stops big companies taking that initiative themselves.
Yeah.
Because, you know, but making an acquisition is an expensive way to grow in the end, and especially if the acquisition isn't what you wanted it to be, or it doesn't live up to expectations. Whereas if you're growing and incubating yourself and giving your own people the chance to develop these ideas, it feels like a stronger place to go. But having looked at this, you know, you're right to say it's the entrepreneurs that tend to get there first. You know, if you take a marginal behavior, which is home burials. So we looked at home burials. So this is people who would rather bury their, remember their loved ones at home. Now, when we looked at that as a behavior and we did focus groups with mainstream people, you would inevitably get the kind of, well, you know, I can't really bury my dad on my balcony, can I? There's sort of, doesn't work for me. But what we found was there was a huge amount of interest in alternative ways to remember loved ones. So then you broaden it out a bit. And then we looked at entrepreneurs that are in the space, and there's some really amazing entrepreneurial businesses, like a company called Recompose, who take a body and they decompose it in a sustainable way, and it becomes a rich plant matter, basically. Using, I think it's falafel sprouts they use, but it's alternate, and then you use that rich plant matter in a beloved rose or a beloved part of the garden. And there are other innovative companies that are using carbon to create diamonds. But really it's about, what's this behavior telling us? What it's telling us is people want alternative ways to remember their loved ones. And there must be loads of ideas out there that could add value in that area. And let's face it, you know, it's not a category that's going away anytime soon, you know, so it's a pretty safe bet.
So let's dig into maybe one or two examples. I really like, maybe we can talk about veganism a little bit, because in the book you talk about what you describe as beacons, and we'll get into that as we talk about these examples. And the there's a couple of them that I love, and particularly I love reframing and I love dilution. And for the listener, there's like 8 or 10 different beacons that I'll let you describe what they are. And so, you know, dilution and reframing are just two of those examples. But can we talk about any example you want in the context of those beacons? And those beacons sort of are indicators of what needs to exist in order for something to ultimately scale.
Exactly right. Well, you know, you've described it for me, really. One of the big ambitions here was not to just go, here's a behavior, veganism, or here's a behavior, polyphasic sleeping. It was to go, how can we understand that behavior better and its potential for mainstream? And these beacons are codes, clues, signs, motifs that provide you with a lens through which to look at a behavior. And if you look at the behavior through the lens of these 8 beacons, it gives you a better idea as to whether or not that behavior is likely to go mainstream. And when we developed the scales, so we developed a model, a quantitative scale, it was based on a questionnaire around the beacons, and then we were able to see which behaviors came to the top. But yeah, there are a couple of key ones. There's signs, signals, clues, and motifs, because some of them are about understanding. So a key one around understanding, and I will come to reframing, is resistance. You know, if you were to go out and do a classic piece of research on any of these behaviors with mainstream people, you get resistance. You get them going, well, no, I mean, it's, you know, it's not for me. And normally, if you'd asked a research company to do that, they would just come back and say, no, it's not, people don't like it, you're going to have to drop it. Whereas what we did is we dug in And we wanted to understand the nature of the resistance. And one of the things we discovered is that resistance is on a spectrum. And there are different types of resistance. And you need to know what your type of resistance is, because it will make a difference to its potential to go mainstream. So when the resistance is visceral, it's like, no, I think it could threaten my life. And for some people, microdosing is that. Then your ability to be able to move it into the mainstream is more difficult. Whereas if the resistance is more, that's interesting, but really impractical from my point of view. And microdosing was at both ends. So for some people, it's interesting, but impractical because it's illegal. Then, you know, watch out for legislation change, because those people will jump on it. And so understanding resistance, rather than just going, well, they don't like it, knowing what kind of resistance have we got here? Is it emotional, or is it practical, or is it really visceral, or is it one of those things that is okay for others but not for me? Really important. Then there are other beacons where the marketer, we as marketers, have got agency, okay? And reframing and dilution is one of them. So can we as marketers use our knowledge and our ingenuity and our imagination to reframe a particular behavior so that the mainstream see it in a different light? And that's all reframing is. It's like reframing the lens through which you see something.
I got to share an example of this. I used to work on an automotive brand, and we were working on its sustainability strategy. And this was obviously like all of the brands a number of years back. They were very much reliant on internal combustion engines, but EVs were on the radar. And so we were sort of put on a corporate initiative to begin to promote EVs. It wasn't until Tesla that anybody that I recall or anybody I ever interviewed about electric vehicles inside an automotive organization talked about performance as being a major advantage for electric vehicles. It was all hinged upon environmental impact and better for the environment. Tesla never played so much in that space. Tesla was the first brand that I recall, maybe I'm wrong, but the first brand that I recall where a strong level of awareness was built around the 0 to 60 performance of an electric vehicle. And I always remember thinking, why was nobody talking about it? And my opinion is there wasn't really an interest in going mainstream with EVs at that time. It was a sense of obligation to develop the product, but not a willingness to mainstream it. Where Tesla then came in as a startup and blew that entire market apart. So I think that's an example of reframing, right?
Yes, it is. It's changing the frame through which you see something. It comes from cognitive psychology. Actually, and it's changing the frame through which somebody views something. And in fact, we looked at this because we wanted to try it out on insect protein. So one of the things we found on insect protein, on resistance, it's at the visceral end. That is disgusting. I would never do it. Insects, yuck, dirty, creepy crawlies, no. And then what we started to do, because we wanted to understand resistance, we wanted to understand reframing, we started to expose more and more information about insect protein. And what's interesting about insect protein is most people know it's a really good source of protein and it's very sustainable, but still disgusting, won't do it. And a lot of the entrepreneurial businesses out there are playing off the insectness of it. So crunchy critters and, you know, cricket bars. And that doesn't help people who think it's disgusting. We then started to talk about the fact that insect protein comes from our ancestral past. So we shared this with people and said, you know, it's nothing new about insect protein. It comes from our ancestral past. Our ancestors used it. It's been part of the food chain for hundreds of years. And then we ended up saying, you know, and maybe we should think about it more as the original protein rather than some sort of new food. Now, the difference that made was incredible, because then you got people going, well, if it was called original protein, and maybe if it came from a brand I knew, well, then maybe I would try it. And that's from someone who went, no, disgusting, I would never do it. Reframing is so powerful.
And, you know, to my example about electric vehicles were not seen as appealing for people who weren't motivated by environmental impact and fuel efficiency back then. But if you put it in the context of performance, it becomes appealing to the mass. So it's a masterful replay and a reframing, repositioning.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's a really good example. And the other one you asked me about actually was dilution, which I think is very, again, it's in the gift of marketers and our imaginations and our ingenuity, which is very often mainstream people are sort of, they like the idea of something, but they don't want to jump in wholesale. And I think that's what happened with veganism. You know, when veganism started, and then for many decades, when nobody else in the mainstream was a vegan, it was a vociferous minority who were fully committed to being a vegan. And now what's happened, of course, is we are all, or many of us, are vegan some of the time. You know, we can choose to be a vegan at certain times. And that comes from dilution. That comes from saying, you know, you can have a vegan Wednesday, or you can choose this vegan milk when you want to. And I think, again, the marketers have the imagination and the ingenuity to dilute a behavior. I think we've also seen it in meditation, you know, and mindfulness. It doesn't have to be a full on, you know, 6 weeks with a, you know, with people chanting. You can take a little bit of it, still get something, get some value out of that behavior. And that's what dilution is. And again, it's within the gift of us as marketers to think about, how could I dilute this? Because clearly there's people who are interested in it and they want to do it. So how can I make it easier for them to get the value out of it?
Generally, when these sort of marginal behaviors are being commercialized at an entrepreneurial level, it's been advocated as a sort of a purist lifestyle or purist choice that if you want to be vegan, you got to be vegan 24/7, right? And what you're saying is that ultimately what can happen in order for something to go mainstream is it has to lose that rigidity and that purist sense in order for people to be able to adopt it as part of their health regimen, rather than it being, I got to buy into the whole thing.
Exactly right. Although there's an odd tension there, because I think if you don't have the purists, then the behavior would never have got traction in the first place. So you sort of need those purists, those pure vegans who would now call people like me a dirty vegan, because I don't do veganism all the time. You need the purists. So you need to respect the purists.
At each stage or you know, at all stages or just in the early stage? Do you need to have the purists in the mix even when you mainstream?
Well, I think you need them in the early stages, because if they resist what you're doing, it could kill it as it gets into the mainstream. So a really good example of that is Wicca, you know, modern day witchcraft, loved by many young, mainly women, but not all women and men. It's loved, and it speaks volumes, I think, about the values of that generation around spirituality, storytelling, female empowerment. So if I was a brand in beauty, in fashion, I would be looking to Wicca and what it tells me about a generation that's hard to understand. Now, what's interesting about Wicca is Sephora, a few years ago, actually launched, I think it was like a witch's starter kit, and it got absolutely berated by people who really believe in Wicca. And it just wasn't really picked up by mainstream either, because it was just a bit, you know, it's sort of not really one thing or the other. And it's sort of putting on that coat of trying to look cool, but without actually doing it. Whereas if Sephora had gone, actually, we've got a group of people here who are really, what they want is, you know, spirituality, storytelling, and female empowerment. Now, what could we do around there in beauty, rather than just come straight down the line and say, let's put a witch's starter kit together?
All of that, I think our audience is going to love. And so what they're going to be thinking about now is the category that they live in themselves, the space, the territory that they live in. So we've been talking about the beacons, and the book does a phenomenal job for the listener of explaining each of the 8 beacons and giving you examples for each of them. So I'll let everybody look to the book for that. Let's talk about how we then apply it to our category. So some of the examples that we've served up, we can relate to. Maybe they're direct or indirectly associated with our category. But let's just say I'm looking at my category. How do I go about the process of discovering sort of the specific marginal movements that exist in my category or in my near and distant categories that surround me? Is there a process? Is there a way that you suggest doing that?
Yeah, well, there's a process in the book, which is the whole of chapter 9 is devoted to a playbook, which is kind of, okay, if you want to do it, here's the process that you should go through, and you could just follow it and do it. And part of the reason to put together the scale, so basically I worked with a research company, and we created a statistical model through which we then put just 20 behaviours, and I'll probably do it again at the end of the year. So a starting point would be to go, okay, well, which behaviours are in the top 10 and which are relevant to my category or I could respond to in some way is a decent starting point. But I suppose what I would say is not to narrow too fast. When I've been working with companies more recently on this, what we've tended to do is to pick off 3 or 4 behaviours that feel relevant or interesting to the category or our audience, and then begin to think about how could we respond to it. And the response can be, you know, it can be in 3 different ways, really. You can come straight down the line at it, you know, see, living off the sea is a massive opportunity. People are very open to it. Could I bring it into my food product? Or you can look at it as, what does it tell me? What is this behavior telling me about these people? So my wicker example. And the third way actually is more, could I use this as inspiration to help me break through a really difficult category? You know, do a lot of work on pain, for example, really difficult category. She's only really got 2 actives. And the team looked at people who experience pain for pleasure to give us, which is a marginal behavior, to give us an insight into an alternative insight into a category. And it really did. So I think there are 3 ways you can use marginal behaviors, but it's to pick off 3 or 4 that you think are relevant to your category, and then to be super imaginative about how you could respond to it. So I was talking to a group of leaders here at London Business School a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the quantified self, which is the daily measurement of biometrics. And somebody who led a big financial services company said, hey, why don't we use that sort of inspiration for helping people manage their finances better? You know, we can bring across some of what people get out of measuring their biometrics into the world of finance, which was so enlightening.
In your book, you talk about sort of looking, I think you were talking about, if I'm remembering this right, looking to social media or to social or user-generated content sources to begin to look for what's hot, what's not hot in a social, in terms of a trending, but something that's garnering attention of a small group of people, and that's sort of a different take on things. Is that part of what you need to do? Is you need to sort of scrape social and understand what sort of is gaining traction in your space?
Yeah, in order to get to the behaviors, so as I said, we got to 47 of them. I actually hired a TV documentary researcher to help me do this. And she had, and I think she wrote, yes, she did. She wrote her methodology, which is in the book, exactly how she did it. And some of that was how she did it. So she would put extreme in front of a word and then look and see what's going on. And it wasn't just social media, you know, social media was the starting point. It was also the media in general. And I think actually, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about is I think we're going to see more marginal behaviors coming to the mainstream. And one of the reasons for that is social media, in that these behaviors are so much more visible to us now. So you can look, you know, you can see it and think, oh, I would like to try that, which without social media, we wouldn't have had access to. So I think social media plays a really important part in sort of looking to see what's going on out there, but also bringing behaviors into the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. It amplifies it enormously. I mean, if you look at the content that's produced for cable channels and for streaming channels, there's so many lifestyles, activities, interests on there that are finding an audience because it's a pretty inexpensive place to put content up and to get exposure for it. And social and streaming channels are really great ways to understand. I suppose a lot of that may have already tipped, but maybe there's also signals underneath that in terms of what's next after what already is today.
Yeah, exactly right. Yes, I think, yes, you're right. I think it's that some people sort of say to me, but what about, you know, influencers? And my view would be, once you've got influencers doing it, if you like, then it's tipped. So, you know, influencers tend to take on something once it's going forward. So you're looking for that pre-influencer areas of behavior that that people are engaging with and find a value in, basically.
For any of us who have been in the industry for a couple of years, we know that innovation and other such initiatives within a company, they are, in retrospect, doomed to fail by virtue of the people sitting around the table. You can't surround yourself with people who are also suffering from the calcification of assumptions inside organizations. And I know that we want to include people from every department. What's your advice for creating a team who's going to be dedicated to developing opportunities, marginal opportunities, as business value opportunities for the future?
I think it's an opportunity for businesses, diversity and inclusion strategies to really become meaningful. You know, so we're talking a lot, quite rightly, about more diversity and inclusion in all businesses. And that's not just diversity of, you know, race and gender. I think it's about diversity of thought and bringing people in with different backgrounds and thought processes. Now, if you pull together a team like that who have had different backgrounds, think in different ways, then I think you can bring in, that's the kind of team I would put together. So I think a driver for this, or a reason to do it, is also, you know, we talk a good game in big corporates about diversity and inclusion, but rather than it be a tick box exercise, let's use diversity and inclusion to give us a competitive advantage. And I think this is where it could.
If you form the right team, and I know the book does a good job of explaining how to do that, the ultimate question becomes, how do you know when you're backing the right horse? I mean, you really don't know, but how do you sort of best sort of shape it in your favor? If you've uncovered 5 or 10 potential marginal behaviors, how do you decide which is the best horse to bet on?
Well, I think in all honesty, you can never be sure. Fair to say, you can never be sure. And I would also, I think I've said earlier, advocate this being part of your innovation budget. I think it's about experimenting. So it's classic sort of lean startup principles. I think it's about, you know, what can we do in a low cost experimental way to nudge around this behavior and see where it takes us, and then iterative movement from there. That is what I would do. So I think there's a lot you can do to understand these behaviors through the lens of the beacons to see which ones are more likely to become mainstream. And you know, we've given people a scale of behaviors. They start in the top 10 of that scale. And then I think it's about experimenting and nudging and understanding more iteratively until you kind of get it right. Because as you said, you know, these behaviors, it's not like a trend where it's all over in a year. They can take a few years to take off. But, you know, Phil Knight talked about Nike. I think he said something like, we didn't invent the exercise revolution, but we sure rode it for one hell of a ride. And he's right. They didn't invent it. People jogging invented it, you know, but they did ride it. And I think it's about being there and supplying and diluting and reframing so that more people can get value out of a behavior that people clearly do value. It's something they want to do with their lives.
You touched on this earlier, this idea of sort of skeptics and cynics, that there's going to be a level of resistance. But one of the other things you note in the book is that in many ways, this is a perfect time for this, given the next generation that are coming along here, consumers that are coming along here. You know, I hate labels, but we're talking about this new emerging Generation Z. And it is fair to say that this is a generation that on a mass level, I think is far more reluctant to use labels, far more optimistic, less cynical, less judgmental, less likely to consider things, lifestyles, choices, strange, and are willing to experiment and experience new things. And I think it is fair to say from what I've read that that is probably a larger percentage of this generation than in prior generations. And that this generation is, you know, it's 32% of the global population. Is that fair to say that this sort of makes it a perfect alignment for experimentation?
Yeah, I agree with you on all fronts in that I don't really like, it's established marketing sin to treat every generation as if they're exactly the same, but they certainly are sort of, I guess, there are some tendencies within a generation, and you're right, Gen Z are one of the biggest, I think the biggest actually cohort at the moment. And what I would again say is, you know, it was striking when we were doing focus groups with Gen Z mainstream people and showing them marginal behaviors. And when we were showing, you know, different generations, Gen X or boomers, marginal behaviors, the boomers or the other generations, they were really open about going, oh, no, I would never do that. That's absolutely disgusting. Whereas what was interesting when you watch Gen Z is that they almost stopped themselves from that visceral response. So the response you would get, you would see a kind of, oh, no, that's disgusting. Or if it's naturism, oh, God, no, I would never do that. You could see it, but they wouldn't say it. What they would say was, well, obviously, we're really open-minded and it's live and let live. And, you know, if people want to do that, I'm open to it. And I think they believe that. So they sort of almost overcome their visceral response to be much more open-minded about it. And I think you're right, those characteristics around curiosity, they're non-tribal, very open, very accepting, we saw that throughout in our own sort of primary data and research, actually.
So are there stages that generally happen in a movement that allows it to sort of better achieve mainstream? We talked earlier about the sort of the purist early stage, but is there, like, are you better off coming in at the very earliest stage, or is there a stage between tipping and early entrepreneurial where you can begin to sort of increase your odds of commercializing this in a way that grows share or grows revenue?
I think that's a really interesting observation, actually, because I think it's very easy to be quite simplistic and say either be early or be too late. And I think you're right to say that there probably is a stage where you've got quite a lot of fizzy entrepreneurial activity and, you know, you understand the resistance and there is intensity, but maybe you could reframe or dilute. And I think one thing to really look out for is an accelerator. So is something happening in the wider culture, or has something happened in the wider culture or wider environment, it might be legislation, that would give this behavior a shove, in which case you would need to be on it faster. So
interesting.
COVID has given behaviors a shove. I think COVID has given the quantified self, that daily measuring of biometric data, a real shove. COVID has given polyphasic sleeping a shove. Legislation change on microdosing will give that a shove. And I think we've got to have our eyes open to not just the behaviors themselves, but also what's going on in the wider environment that might bring about a sudden change, or not sudden in terms of months, but in terms of like a year. You know, so in America and the exercise revolution, it was sedentary lifestyles, completely different new ways of working, heart disease. Wow. Okay. Something needs to change.
I really enjoyed the book. It's called From Marginal to Mainstream, Why Tomorrow's Brand Growth Will Come from the Fringes. You can get it on Amazon. And I think that while some of what we're talking about today, we're talking about part of an innovation budget, I think as strategists, we're always encouraged to look at the fringes for what can inspire our strategies, for what can be executed upon today from a even from an existing set of products that we can use in positioning and messaging. So I love to hear different perspectives on how that sort of fringe can inform everything we do. Helen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
It is Helen Edwards. She's author of From Marginal to Mainstream. She's also a columnist, regular columnist for Marketing Week, and an adjunct associate professor at London Business School, and my God, you do a lot of things, and owner of Passion Brand Consultancy in London. Helen, great to have you here.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Fergus.
And we'll see everyone on the next episode.